are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday. What month is it? March 21st. Literally spaced that. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. Five-time award-winning. Whew. Sam is rubbing off on me. Five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Richard Beck, associate editor of N Plus One. We're talking about the Korean peace process, understanding the deeper dynamics at play, North Korean political history, U.S. military policy, the role of the South Korean president condescended to in the U.S. press, but essential and fighting for peace on the peninsula. We'll get to that. New Zealand's prime minister, Jacinda Ardern, showing real leadership, immediate bans on assault weapons after the Christchurch terrorist attack that killed 50 worshippers at a mosque. Mozambique rescue operations underway as over 1,000 have been reported dead, and women and babies are trapped in trees. There's a race to rescue people who sought refuge on higher elevations. John McCain, he might be passed on, but he's still bothering Donald Trump. Andrew Gillum proving once again that not only should he have been governor of Florida, but he is one of our most promising and important politicians in the United States. He is unveiling an amazing voter registration effort and voter civil rights protection effort in Florida. Wouldn't it be awesome if Beto O'Rourke did something like that instead of wasting everybody's time? GOP governor of Kentucky doesn't believe in vaccines, essentially, apparently. That's interesting. Not particularly surprising, actually. And credit where credit is due, Beto O'Rourke slams Benjamin Netanyahu for playing to racists. I wonder if people will go after him the way they did Ilhan Omar. Guessing probably not, for a variety of reasons. Joe Biden continues to make his play. Mike Pence used to talk real dirty, real spicy behind Donald Trump's back. A campaign to free Lula relaunches in Brazil as new questions surround the Lava Jato investigation that put him in jail. In fact, they just got several million dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, from the Justice Department of the United States. Civil fines rebated to them without any oversight. Even as Michel Temer, the Brazilian president who took over after the coup against Dilma Rousseff, was arrested today on Lava Jato-related corruption charges. He served his purpose, and they need to reclaim their legitimacy. Iranian human rights lawyer is sentenced to 30 years in prison and 30 lashes. We stand in solidarity with her after that obscene policy, that obscene decision. Iran's president says their economy is in a serious danger. And President Erdogan heading into regional elections in a couple of months, increasing his authoritarian grip, makes his play to shore up the Turkish economy. All that, plus youth protesters across the globe take action on the climate crisis, all that and more on today's Majority Report. I think when John McCain died, we were all, as you should be with a public figure, really focused on his public output. But as much as I was not a fan of John McCain politically or militarily, and as much as I am, I'm an anti-fan of Meghan McCain. I've come to agree with the Brendan Finn position that Meghan McCain's existence in the public sphere is a walking argument against oligarchy, inherited wealth, position, and dynasties. So I guess in a weird way, she's sort of serving an anti-purpose.
Yep.
But I, I just want to say this. And of course, what I think of Donald Trump, what we think of Donald Trump is a whole other thing. I mean, he's one of the worst people on the planet, a grotesque buffoon racist who is harming the country every day.
It's a world historical tragedy that he's in power.
It is a world historical tragedy he's in power. But I will say this, and this I guess also implicates, we're going to actually, this is a teaser for some stuff we might be doing tomorrow possibly, but I know there's a lot of atheists on this show. I know there's a lot of people who don't believe in the non-material world. I'm agnostic on these things, but I will say if John McCain is in any capacity still bothering Donald Trump, he should stop. And, you know, because it's enough. The fact that Donald Trump needs to come out here and speak about John McCain. I don't know. Is it because Donald Trump is a milk brain who can never let go of a grudge? Is it because Donald Trump is so out of it that he thinks John McCain is still alive? Or is there some, you know, way that we can't speculate that maybe Donald Trump is actually still being bothered by John McCain? We really don't know. But whatever it is, it needs to stop. This is Donald Trump yesterday taking the very much not with us anymore John McCain to task. And I got to say, frankly, I think he has a point.
I endorsed him at his request, and I gave him the kind of funeral that he wanted, which as president, I had to approve. I don't care about this. I didn't get thank you. That's okay. We sent him on the way, but I wasn't a fan of John McCain. So now what we could say is now we're all set. I don't think I have to answer that question, but the press keeps, what do you think of McCain? What do you think? Not my kind of guy, but some people like him, and I think that's great.
It's like the only thing that separates Donald Trump from being a complete sociopath is that most sociopaths were socially conditioned to feign basic human etiquette.
Well, yeah,
it's like you're not supposed to say that.
But you don't. That guy. If you're born really wealthy, you'd never have to learn that stuff. It's not. There's not the selective pressure on
right.
you to learn
That's
that.
True.
I'm trying to find it. I think Jake Tapper might have deleted a tweet, but he had a tweet about how like one of his veteran sources was texting him, and he was like,
yeah.
"How could? Isn't there any Republican going to stand up to this? How can
this no. day hurts my soul?
No.
Like,
the point
is like Jake Tapper is like you shouldn't be just passing that tweet along or that text along through tweet. You should be wondering why one of your viewers, especially one that has your number, is so confused about what to expect from the Republican Party.
Right. That text should be, oh my God, I'm totally incompetent and not doing my job. I'm on TV. I'm on national cable every single day talking and pontificating for hours and doing my serious concerned face. And somehow you have still not conveyed to your viewers that the Republican Party will never. I mean, there was like, you know, with Ben Sasse voting for the border wall emergency thing, right? The market of and the pinnacle, he isn't even there anymore, and I honestly forget his name, but who was the nothing burger from Arizona who was always
Jeff Flake,
the aptly named
Snowflake.
Snowflake.
He's born in Snowflake, New Mexico. Literally.
Literally?
Yeah, he's
that's great. The aptly named Jeff Flake. Like there was a time a year or two ago, certainly 2 years ago, and somewhat a year ago, where there was a big market for I don't do anything to stop the Trump agenda. In fact, I support making the environment worse. I support increasing poverty. I support handing America to corporations. I support legally establishing a full oligarchy and reversing democracy. But boy, gee golly, I will get on the Senate floor and talk about how rude Donald Trump is. And now you see with Ben Sasse, I mean, Ben Sasse, he had an opportunity to cast a little bit of a vote there, and because he's the whole mantle of, ooh, I'm so concerned about this, and we're not all a bunch of friggin' racists, went on to him, and there ain't a market for that anymore. So if Jake Tapper can't even follow the trend of a lot of people pretending to disassociate with Trump while voting with Trump all the time, or 99% of the time, or 90% of the time, this was the moment where, you know, you've just fallen into a complete and utter Oh, this is great. Just total, not only irrelevant, I mean, just pure incompetence. Jake Tapper, combat vet. Always with the combat vets with this guy. Combat vet texts me. Trump's McCain comments hurt my soul. And by the way, I just want to say, I'm sure they did. You know, okay. They were, I can't even call them graceless. You're right, Matt. They're just in the, I mean, Donald Trump is a horrible, wretched human being. Trump's McCain comments hurt my soul. How have we arrived at a place where this is even possible? And how can the Republican leadership stand on this? Have we no decency? Well, let me do it in reverse order. No, you don't. And secondly, the Republican leadership has stood there while Donald Trump has actually done stuff. And they want to do things that will harm irreparably, Jesus, tens of millions of people. They are with it. So, okay, you know, so the fact that Jake passes, I mean, is just delusional. He's the journalist. This other guy could be the deluded citizen. Yeah. But Jake Tapper has no excuse.
I mean, imagine if you knew Jake Tapper, you knew a premier newsman, and you just believe this bullshit. Like, maybe we will have Jeff Flake or Ben Sasse do something to right the ship. Like, nah, it's never happening.
Never. Never.
I think the nice little like side story here is that reports are that Johnny Isaacson and Mitt Romney have been the ones who said, "This is wrong, sir. How dare you? Have you no decency?"
Oh, great.
And meanwhile, like, John McCain's best friend, his little buddy, Lindsey Graham's kicking off his 2020 campaign with Mike Pence in South Carolina, and everyone's asking him what's going on, and he's like, can't say anything because he doesn't want to get primaried.
Times, you got to keep moving with the. There ain't no loyalty in this game. When John McCain was here, I was with him. Now I fucks with Donald Trump.
It's like the cheese monologue in The Wire.
Yeah.
ain't no loyalty in this. I'm trying to bomb Korea. I'm trying to start a war with Iran. Trying to get those Fox and Friends hits. This ain't about love. John McCain was around. I looked at pictures of him in his Navy uniform and I loved him then. But then Donald Trump won. And then John McCain died. And now I love Mr. Trump. Ain't no consistency to this. Grow up.
Ugh, my God. I mean, if you're still waiting on something from Lindsey Graham, I mean, you are clinical. That I mean, Lindsey Graham is, I think, essentially said to you, I'm not like a moral person.
Yeah.
Borderline, you know, like.
Go where you get the influence.
All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break and we will be right back with Richard Beck. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Richard Beck. He's an associate editor at N+1. In his new piece, The Korean Peace Process, or actually this piece was published a bit ago, but he is a sort of premier watcher and analyst of this process. Richard, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what happened in Vietnam? How did that process unwind itself?
As far as I can tell, there's a fair amount of blame to go around for what happened in Vietnam. I think that you had some misconceptions on both sides going into the second summit that resulted in its failure. So you have Trump going in with the sort of expected overestimation of his own abilities as a negotiator.
Right.
I think that Kim and his team might have gone in with sort of unrealistic expectations for how little the U.S. would be willing to accept. And then I've also read quite a bit suggesting that John Bolton really might have thrown a wrench into the whole process kind of at the last minute. I don't think it's any secret or any surprise that he doesn't particularly want to have peace with North Korea. And my understanding from an article I'd read, I think, in The Guardian, but it might have been somewhere else, is that he tacked on some demands at the last minute or convinced Trump to make these demands just before the actual negotiation started, and that this was, you know, a surprise and sort of totally unacceptable to the North Koreans. So I think that there's a lot of, you know, a shared responsibility for what happened. It wasn't a totally useless summit insofar as specifics did get laid out on the table, specific demands, specific requests, which hadn't been the case in Singapore. Singapore was this kind of, you know, very, very general meet and greet, let's celebrate our relationship sort of event. But coming out of Vietnam, you know, it's a big setback, but at least both sides now have a more realistic understanding of where they're at.
What is let me just do this one first. How does the president of South Korea fit into this? Because from my read, he's very important and is an extremely positive force. You kind of point out that he's been sort of treated either a bit condescendingly or kind of as an afterthought. How does the failure of the process in Vietnam affect his domestic position, and what do you think his role in all of this has been?
Well, his domestic position is somewhat weaker than it was at the beginning of the process. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the South Korean economy has been struggling recently. Mm-hmm. But certainly the peace process with North Korea is the centerpiece, or one of the centerpieces of his domestic policy, the centerpiece of his foreign policy. It's enormously, enormously important to him that it succeed. And I think that he's the one who really jump-started the whole thing. When you had this episode a year or two back of Trump and Kim exchanging these dire threats and missile tests and, you know, missiles being launched, you know, flying over Japan, that opened up some space, maybe a little counterintuitively, for South Korea to step in and say, to take a leadership role in trying to calm things down, because it was obvious that Trump wasn't able to do that, but he wasn't interested in doing that. And I think that around East Asia, you know, in South Korea certainly, but also in China to some extent, people lost a little bit of faith in their ability to trust that the U.S. would be a stabilizing force. So it allowed South Korea to take a more active role.
What are the sticking points? Or maybe more specifically, what are the poison pills that Bolton put in there to undermine this process in Vietnam?
The big sticking point, and it's kind of a big general one, is this idea of complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. And the U.S. demand that North Korea completely denuclearize, shut down all of its facilities, dismantle its facilities, let in inspectors, give them a detailed list of everything they have before any sanctions are going to be removed. North Korea has come in saying, we want sort of a step-by-step tit-for-tat approach. We'll shut down some research facility, you lift a sanction. We will dismantle some other facility, you lift another sanction. And they have proposed this as a kind of trust building exercise. You know, let's see if you'll take these baby steps in good faith, and then we can move on to bigger and bigger stuff. And so far, the U.S. has been unwilling to consider this graduated approach. Their demand is you shut everything down, and then we'll talk about getting rid of some sanctions. I think that North Korea is justified in being suspicious of the U.S. when they say you shut everything down and then we'll lift sanctions, because all they have to do is look at the experience of Libya and Gaddafi, who did shut down his weapons program and got killed in exchange for it.
And also, of course, we had a successful and working deal with Iran, which Trump just, you know, hasn't entirely blown up, because the Europeans are maintaining it, and the Chinese and the Russians as well, obviously, in India, but has seriously undermined and shown that basically our commitment and our word means nothing in these types of negotiations. I think that's actually a really important point. Maybe that does overlap even in some ways, particularly with understanding Iran or even Libya. And of course, these are all very, very different governments, different regimes, and it's difficult to communicate about this, I think, in the press here, because some people sort of, you know, radically overcorrect, and they'll say, well, actually, you know, Gaddafi didn't, not only was Gaddafi a rational interlocutor, but he didn't even have human rights problems, and that's that's ridiculous. Or, you know, Iran, I would say of the three, actually, Iran is definitely the most complicated in terms of assessing their human rights areas. But of course, I mean, we just talked about an activist, an attorney who's just sentenced to 30 years in prison and 30 lashes for doing her work in Iran just this week. It's obscene, you know, an abomination. And of course, North Korea, it's, you know, very well documented, the sort of scale of abuses that take place in North Korea. On the other hand, the problem is that in the discourse here, it's conflated. It's like, oh, well, if they do that here, then obviously there are irrational actors abroad. Obviously, they would sort of blow themselves up in a flame of glory. And, you know, in each of these cases, that's clearly not the case. These are rational governments and leaders that want to survive. And that might be the hardest case to actually convey to people about North Korea, because we have such a kind of warped view of them. I mean, even some of the ways that we actually talk about real abuses in North Korea are very dehumanizing. It's like, oh, well, look at this other, you know, totally insane thing that they did. And, you know, look at the bouffant hairdos and all of this. When it's like, well, no, actually, it's extremely brutal and people are actually really suffering. And then on the other hand, no, there's a strategy in place here, and these people know how to survive and they know how to play their position. So I mean, first of all, I gave you a lot. I don't know whether you agree with that frame or not, but I think that might be a good starting point when you talk about their legitimate demands, to talk about the ways in which the North Korean leader is actually quite different than Donald Trump, for all the kind of superficial, easy comparisons. And where is North Korea coming from in terms of solidifying themselves and surviving as a regime? Like, what are their rational self-interest positions in all of this?
I mean, you're right that was there was a lot there in what you said. Just to go back to part of what you said earlier to start off with, the way that I read when American commentators bring up North Korea's human rights record, which is very bad, and try and use that record as a justification for not entering into this peace process, not supporting it, I basically don't think that kind of commentary is worth very much. Right. I think that when you have human rights activists, people who actually are committed to these problems and to solving them, talking about it, you can take that a little bit more seriously. When it's coming from, you know, John Bolton or any of the other Trump administration ghouls who are totally happy to support the invasion of Iraq, would like to invade Iran one day, I think it's okay to say that those arguments are being made in bad faith.
Definitely.
It's also just, even outside of it being in bad faith, there's a kind of surrealism to it where, like, okay, yes, I acknowledge that the human rights record is very bad. What do you want to do about it? Isolation, sanctions, demonization, that doesn't seem to be improving much. Obviously, what would help open up North Korea to the rest of the world, help the regime to adopt less of a paranoid stance, is to be kind of integrated into the community of nations as, you know, an equal functioning member. I think everyone knows at this point that there is no military solution to this problem that anyone would be happy with. Kim doesn't want war to erupt because his regime would be immediately destroyed. The U.S. doesn't want war to erupt because, and South Korea doesn't want war to erupt because of the tens and hundreds of thousands of people who would die as a result. It's just obvious at this point that anyone talking about starting a war is, you know, this bluster.
Right.
As for the Kim regime itself and what its interests are, the thing it really wants is security guarantees. It wants to be able to believe in a real way that the U.S. is not going to try and overthrow the Kim regime. Mm-hmm. And it wants these sanctions lifted so that its economy can begin the process of catching up to the rest of the developed world. Those are the two things that are really driving it.
And how do you, and so, and you have a really good graph where you really outline like the differences between Trump and Kim for all of the superficial similarities. And I maybe you could elaborate on that, because I think that it, again, the reason I brought the human rights stuff into it is because it's not like a moral justification of somebody, you know, but it's like, this isn't just like a caricature or a meme or something. This is somebody who comes,
right.
You know, that's what I'm, so maybe could you kind of break that down,
yeah,
the lineage of this family and what's going on here in terms of, you know, how to understand these people.
I mean, that was one of the first things that really frustrated me about the media coverage of the peace process when it started up, was this kind of easy, this drawing, this like very, very easy comparison between Trump and Kim. Here are two sort of brash, loud, buffoonish characters. They both have awful hair.
Right.
They're both overweight. They both see themselves as little despots. And so now we have these two clowns, you know, going to Singapore to congratulate each other on how great they are. And if you actually look at the political position of both leaders, it's totally different. Kim is in a ruling line that has controlled North Korea for decades and decades, that has deep historical roots in the country's struggle against colonialism throughout the 20th century. The entire political system in North Korea revolves around his family's rule. He's at the very, very center of it. If the Kim regime were to collapse, it would mean a total and complete upheaval of North Korean society. Whereas Donald Trump is essentially a media figure who was able to take advantage of the fractured character and the weaknesses of one of America's two major political parties to assume its leadership. He has no roots in the political system whatsoever. I don't think he particularly has many deeply held political beliefs. I think that his motivating forces are sort of his narcissism, having mm-hmm. people say nice things about him on television. So he's just, Trump is a very politically sort of superfluous figure in the U.S., despite the fact that everything seems to revolve around him right now, whereas Kim is, you know, totally central to the political system in North Korea and to its history.
Just, I want to loop back to where we go from here, relative mainly to the U.S. and North Korea in the last couple of minutes. Before we go there, we talked about the really important role that the President Moon has played in South Korea. And, you know, part of that, my read is, you know, he represents the center left in South Korea, and that party historically, even under, you know, like Kim Dae-jung, and when Clinton was president, they pursued something called the Sunshine Policy, which was definitely not as far reaching as what they're talking about now, but it was some type of diplomatic arrangement. And then obviously the right wing.
Yeah. And it made real progress.
Yeah. Actually, you want to explain that for a second? That could be helpful.
So the Sunshine Policy was a policy pursued between North and South Korea during the Clinton years. And this is sort of before, it's sort of hard to remember that this happened because everything went so sour once Bush took office and named North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil. Mm-hmm. But the Clinton years did see a real improvement in U.S.-North Korean relations, in North-South Korean relations. Clinton wasn't quite able to make progress on his own, but he sent Jimmy Carter over to meet with leadership over there. And it was real progress. By the end of the decade, people were very optimistic, not necessarily that the war was going to end, you know, peace treaty was going to be signed imminently, but that things, there was a base that had been laid down to work from. And then Bush just blew the whole thing up once he named North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil. But sorry, you can go back to what you were saying.
No, maybe could, and then did Obama, I mean, there was this sort of approach of like, what do they call it? Like sort of strategic patience that what did Obama do? What was the Obama years like?
Obama didn't do a whole lot. He maintained economic sanctions. I think that his efforts were really focused on Iran, that his administration's calculation was that it was more important to address Iran first. And I think that he was kind of happy to punt a little bit on North Korea, in part because he assumed that another Democrat would be handling the problem.
Right.
If you had told Obama in 2011, no man, in 5 years it's going to be Donald Trump, I think there would have been some more urgency from his administration.
I would imagine.
On North Korea.
Right, right.
But, he was leaving North Korea to whoever was going to follow him, and he expected that that would be, you know, his Secretary of State.
What are the we contrast the kind of constructive role of South Korea under Moon. Now, these are obviously very, very different positions, and they have their own complexities. But is there a way to kind of top line China's role as the kind of main patron of North Korea, and then also Japan, which has its own sort of right-leaning kind of nationalist sort of insurgency or government? What have their roles been in this process?
So China has a very complicated role with North Korea, mm-hmm. which is that China has been North Korea's major patron, but not out of anything that's much like friendship. It's been more out of fear. Mm-hmm. China and North Korea share a border where any kind of war to break out involving North Korea, China would immediately have a gigantic refugee crisis on its hands. And so China, when Trump and Kim initially started ramping up their rhetoric and threatening to annihilate each other, China was sort of paralyzed by the whole thing. It actually cut down its trade with North Korea, I think by something like 90%. To try and help the U.S. really intensify its sanctions. So it wasn't really contributing much in the way of ideas of its own. Once South Korea stepped in and got this peace process going, then China became sort of a more active player in it. And its role has been as kind of a facilitator. Kim has traveled to China to talk about he traveled to China before both the Singapore and the Vietnam summits to talk about negotiating points and to make sure that China was going to be on board with what he was proposing. And also, North Korea has been telling China that they see the U.S. as the greatest security threat and therefore would like to be a little bit closer to China. This way of soliciting Chinese support. Now, apparently, they've also been telling the U.S. that they see China as the greatest security threat. So there's a little bit of strategic manipulation happening there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that as the process has unfolded, China has started to like the idea of peace on the Korean Peninsula more than it would have initially. Because ultimately, peace on the Korean Peninsula would diminish the American role, the American presence in East Asia. Would make it a little bit easier for China to operate. And China right now is really embarked on this project of becoming not a global hegemon, but certainly a regional hegemon. It would like to be kind of the only hegemon functioning in East Asia.
Right. And Japan?
Japan, their government is a little more right-leaning. They have not been as excited about the peace process. Their relationship to the U.S. is obviously much closer. They're going to be less thrilled about a diminished role in East Asia. So far, their approach has been relatively cautious, as far as I can understand, but they haven't seemed to be particularly enthusiastic about it.
Final couple of minutes. I mean, here's the where do we go from here question. Like, is this ongoing, or has Bolton destroyed the process? Like, what can you expect to kind of see in the next coming months?
Well, it's really hard to know what to expect, because the U.S. is in this position now where the U.S. can't dictate events in East Asia anymore like it maybe used to be able to. Mm-hmm. It does not have the clout to, you know, make North Korea denuclearize. It cannot mobilize the support for any kind of invasion or attack on North Korea. But the U.S. is still, unfortunately, an indispensable part of the process. And I say unfortunately just because of the kind of unpredictability and volatility of the people who are doing the negotiating right now.
Yep.
I think that part of what makes it so unpredictable is that, left to his own devices, Trump sort of would give away whatever he needed to get himself a Nobel Peace Prize. And as crazy as it is, I don't think that would be a terrible outcome for the world.
I agree. I agree completely. Right.
And if what it takes to get a formal end to the Korean War signed is a peace prize for Donald Trump, like, I don't care. Fine. Do it.
Sure.
The problem is that you do have these people from the real, you know, sort of right wing foreign policy establishment, people like John Bolton, whose influence seems to increase or decrease depending on the day or the week, or whether, you know, Sean Hannity has said positive or negative things about John Bolton on his previous show. And if those people are in a position to influence Trump's negotiating, like they appear to have been in Vietnam, then yeah, this thing is going to get tanked.
Well, I think that is as good as...
That said,
sorry, go ahead.
Even if the U.S. decides to be, you know, totally unproductive, like a complete non-contributor to this process, North and South Korea especially, seem to have invested so much in opening up their relationship that it's hard to see them going back to where they were before. So I think that you're going to see, I don't know what the relationship looks like if the U.S. Ends up tanking the process to the extent that it's able. But the relationship between North and South Korea is going to be different coming out of this than it was going in. And I think it's going to be better.
Well, that's a positive note. And now is as good a time as any. I mean, I'm sure President Trump is not watching this, but there might be people who are, you know, producers at Fox or whatever. And I think all we can say is, you know, I thought, and what I've heard and what many people are saying, is that John Bolton has been very disrespectful and not treated you with the proper respect. And I think it's very unfair. And Richard and I, you know, we both think you're doing a tremendous job, frankly. Unlike John Bolton, who thinks you're doing a terrible job, and others who have said many things. But we'll say many great things about the negotiations. And I thought it was very sad. And you're doing a great job. But Lion John or something. I don't know. Backstabbing John. Tough stuff.
Backstabbing John.
Backstabbing John. He's up to it again. He's trying to keep you from a Nobel Peace Prize. And could you imagine the look in Ivanka's face when you win that prize?
I mean, the problem with, I agree with what you're saying, but even if John Bolton does fall out of favor, it's not like there aren't 10, 15 other people just as bad waiting to take his place.
Well, we just got to run through all of them. You have to be like, yep. Yep, you got to get him into a Pablo Escobar mindset where he's just everybody. It's like, I think more broadly, I think the instincts to white supremacy and to just kind of general oligarchy, to the extent that Trump thinks about anything, are sincere. Give rich people money and stoke and promote racism, 100%. But I think besides that, I think you're totally right in that this is all a media show and pure narcissism, but the shell around him is this far-right extremist party. And that's another distinction in the discourse, right? A lot still, you know, one of the main arguments, I would say, between the center and the left is how real they are about what the Republican Party is. And you're totally right.
That I also want to say that, like, yes, John Bolton is an extremist on the right. It's not like the support for the peace process coming out of the center of the Democratic Party has been much more meaningful.
Right. 100%.
And I actually think that the Democratic Party does need to shoulder some of the blame for what happened in Vietnam, because they have done everything that they can to undermine the peace process, to denigrate Trump's outreach efforts. You know, they staged the Michael Cohen hearings on the day that he was in Vietnam, and Michael Cohen, you know, specifically address Donald Trump being in Vietnam at the hearings. So it seems obvious to me that those hearings were, the timing of it was designed to undermine Trump's negotiating position in Vietnam, which I think is honestly shameful.
I agree entirely. And I think that, you know, the letters from Schumer and the sort of general hand-wringing from the kind of MSNBC types were stunning. I mean, stunning both because all of a sudden it was either just a sort of knee-jerk commitment to literally decades of failed and actually highly militaristic U.S. foreign policy, or in other cases, I mean, it was just, you know, I'm all for taking as many shots at Trump as you can, but I mean, if you're actually implicating something that might interfere with ending the Korean War, you might want to reassess and focus on literally the thousands or tens of thousands of other things that you can hit this guy on without interfering with that. So I agree with you completely. Richard Beck, he's an associate editor of N+1. Read all of his writings on the Korean peace process. Richard, thanks so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half and with Just the Boys. Do we have that video? On the days that it's Thursday and, you know, Jamie does 4 days a week. So she, and usually Sam goes, no, Jamie comes in on the other days. But sometimes she's here, sometimes she isn't. And then, of course, you know, Sam isn't here. So what does that mean? It means it's the three boys. And it looks a little bit something like, 1 second. Looks a little bit.
Vic Berger just tweets a little bit too often.
Vic Berger is a very active tweeter. Does a lot of tweeting, folks.
Saturday's four. Sean.
Saturday's at four. The boys.
Boys.
Boys
club. Saturday's four. Boys boys. What are Saturday's for?
For the boys.
Here we go.
Boys. Donald, real quick, what are Saturday's for?
For the boys.
Boys.
Saturday's four.
Apparently the boys.
Boys!
Saturdays are for the boys.
Boys!
What's Saturdays for?
The boys.
Boys! Michelle, what's Saturdays for?
The boys!
President, what are Saturdays for? What are Saturdays for?
Working.
Tommy, you know Saturdays are for the boys.
Thursdays are for the
masterpiece.
Boys.
Masterpiece. Thursdays are for the boys.
Wicking.
Wicking. Fucking golfs. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. Less than a cup of coffee a day. Check out justcoffee.coop. Order the Majority Report blend. It's a win-win-win-win-win for all concerned. Check out the Michael Brooks Show. This Sunday, an illicit history of Joe Biden with Zach Carter. Get the whole thing, patreon.com/TMBS. We appreciate all of you. And definitely get your tickets. They're starting to ramp up again. We're over halfway sold out with several weeks left for the April 20th live show, the TMBS live show at the Bootleg Theater in Los Angeles with special guests Big Waz, Anna Kasparian, and Nando Vila, and of course the whole Michael Brooks Show team. Go to Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Subscribe there. We have a ton of clips. Now we're about 3-4 clips a day, so you can get a real flavor of the show. Obviously, similar to the Majority Report, but very history-focused, covering some different beats, and you'll really like what you get over there. Matt?
Yeah, Literary Hangover. We talked about King Philip's War, the 1675 war that people might want to check out. It's pretty formative for colonialism and that sort of stuff. And coming soon, we're going to be talking about Oscar Wilde's The Soul of Man Under Socialism. And he has an interesting quote, actually. Maybe I should just pull this
up. Please do. And also, who is going to be featured?
David Griscom of the Economic Minute at TMBS fame is going to be featured. And he's actually done a theory reading, I think, on The Soul of Man Under Socialism. Yep. But I have this. This is from a 1894 interview with Oscar Wilde. It's with the Theater magazine. It says he likes Jews. He has many friends among the Hebrews. He thinks Spinoza is a very fine character. He seems
Spinoza was a very fine character. Spinoza is great.
He seems to have some doubt as to whether Spinoza was really the founder of the pantheistic sect. And then he said, the conversation drifted into politics. We are all of us more or less socialists nowadays, he remarked. Our system of government is largely socialistic. What is the House of Commons but a socialistic assembly? I think I am rather more of a socialist, he added laughingly. I am something of an anarchist, I believe. But of course, the dynamite policy is very absurd indeed. So it doesn't seem like a lot of these conversations have changed a whole lot in like 20 years.
That's fascinating. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. Back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell of a lot of bank. Hell of a lot of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black Africans. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black, black alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.